KIOS-FM presents another luncheon broadcast from the Omaha Press Club. This program was recorded by KIOS-FM on Thursday, February 20th, 2003, for broadcast at this time. Today's guest speaker will be retired Omaha World Herald columnist Tom Allen, author of To Bucktail and Back, A Million Miles of Memories. He'll talk about his latest book and about his 61-year career as a newspaper man. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of the Omaha Press Club, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the program is Chris Allen, professor of journalism at the University of Nebraska at Omaha and a member of the Omaha Press Club's Education Committee.
Good afternoon. At least once a month, the OPC Education Committee sponsors a noon forum featuring a speaker of interest to the community. Everyone is invited to these luncheon forums. You do not have to be a member of the Press Club to attend. While our guest is speaking today, there are pencils and paper on each table for you to jot down questions for him. We will come around and collect the questions and ask them from the podium. Today's speaker is former World Herald reporter and columnist Tom Allen. No relation. In fact, as he pointed out, I spell my name wrong. Tom has written a book, To Bucktail and Back, A Million Miles of Memory, which is just as it sounds, a memoir of his travels around Nebraska and the people he met along the way. He did that traveling over his 52-year career with the World Herald. I think for anybody who loves meeting people and talking to people, reporting is about the perfect career. But it takes a true talent to entice stories out of those people, and it takes talent to recognize that those people have a story, even when they may not realize it themselves. Tom has done that. The Omaha Press Club honored him in 2001 as the 85th face on the barroom floor, and we are honored to have him back here today. Please welcome Tom Allen.
Hi, I'm a little overcome every time I reach the height of the Omaha Press Club because I am old enough to remember Uncle John Savage's, the founder of the Press Club's, first Press Club. And I say I have reached the ultimate height because that first Press Club was a room that John had conned out of the manager and old age you begin to forget, but it was either the old Rome Hotel or the Hill Hotel. And I swear to God, it looked like a former coal bin down the basement. And John, the only furniture in there was a couple of folding chairs and an old Coke icebox in which John kept the liquor supply, guarded by the biggest lock I have ever seen. And he had the only key. And it was cash on the barrelhead. If you wanted a drink, you had to see John, and he opened up the padlock. There were a lot of creaking and groaning. But that was the beginning. And then I find that my life is a success climbing to this height, the grandeur of this present-day Omaha Press Club. Somebody said I am the, 85th? Face on the barroom floor. I assure you that the whole history of the Press Club, I was a face on the barroom more times than that. But how I came to write this book was it happened when I was inducted into the face on the barroom floor. And my kid sitting over there, Tam, was one of my roasters, and he scared the hell out of me because he began his speech telling how the family had to suffer because of my two mistresses, a love affair with two mistresses, and I was gagging over there, wondering, oh, my God. And he didn't tell names. But finally it dawned on him that he was talking about the World Herald, and particularly Nebraska, who had caused missed anniversaries, missed birthdays, everything else, and long absences. And I thought, well, I better heed a lot of my readers saying, when in the hell are you going to write a book? And I thought, I better heed their admonition and write a book. And so I wrote this book. I sat down and wrote this book. And actually, I borrowed from old clippings and old columns and a lot of memories. And you're wondering, like a lot of readers so far, where in the hell is Bucktail? Has a title, To Bucktail and Back, A Million Miles of Memories. Bucktail is one of the several Sand Hill Ranch House post offices that used to dot the Sea of Grass country. And it is the only, or was the only, government entity in Arthur County outside of the courthouse in Arthur, the only town in Arthur County. But anyway, it exemplifies what I try to tell visitors to Nebraska. And I'm sad to say, to a lot of old Nebraskans, if you really want to find out, to learn of the beauty of Nebraska, to meet its greatest people, to delve in its great historic traditions, heritage, get lost. Get off that damn interstate and get lost and find Bucktails and other small towns. And this is what I've been trying to, I tell young aspiring journalists, not only to get lost when you find your stories, but while aspiring to be Pulitzer Prize winners with just administration shaking stories, don't forget the human equation and stoop to pick a daisy. And by daisies, I mean the little, I was ashamed to write, but I found out that even though in my career at World Herald, I covered all the major catastrophes, floods, tornadoes, blizzards, I covered all the major crimes from Charlie Starkweather on up and down, all the covered presidents and you name it, the stories that got the most response from readers, the ones they still remember, are the little daisies that I dare stoop to pick. And they are the little stories that make your heart beat faster, make you cry, make you laugh. And this is what I tried to do in the book. I covered all the major catastrophes. I covered presidents in here that I have known. But this are the little daisies that, I say, make people laugh, cry, and made me laugh and cry. I was so fortunate. I had the best job in the world at the World Herald. For some reason, they gave me the opportunity to fulfill man's innate desire to learn what's around the next bend of the road, who's over the next hill. And basically, as the World Herald's rowing reporter photographer. And please note the spelling. That's roving, not raving, as they sometimes misspell. That is what I did. A lot of times I would flip a coin, pulling it off from my driveway. Which way will I go? And to find these little stories. And they're all in here. Stories, love stories, mother-son stories, sweetheart stories, crime stories, stories of Nebraska football. I was privileged to cover Nebraska football for 29 years, beginning with the Bill Glassford reign and through the glory days of Bob Devaney and Osborne, the first years of Osborne. And there again, I turned my back on the field of play because I firmly believed there was as much drama and little daisies off the field than there was on the field. And a fitting example is, just give you one, because my keeper there, Christine Berger, says, don't tell them the story, tell them to buy the damn books and read it. But the day that Johnny Rogers, Nebraska's famed Heisman Trophy winner, became a man, it was in the Orange Bowl, what was it, 71, in which we literally ran Alabama out of the bowl. It was over by the end of the first quarter. And Johnny did everything. And it was exciting to watch. But looking for little Daisy, I noted that Johnny's teammate, Rex Lowe, had been brought to the game by his parents in a wheelchair. He was dying of Hodgkin's disease. And afterwards, in the jubilant riot of that locker room, he had been trundled in and was kind of in a corner sitting all by his lonesome. Every focus, all the major press and everybody was on Johnny, rightfully so. And he had been presented the game ball. And Johnny, in that moment that was his to savor, jumped up and he said, guys, we know who this really belongs to. And wound his way with the same elusiveness as he did the Alabama team. He went over the corner and he knelt beside his teammate Rex and said, Rex, this is for me and the guys. You are the greatest and you deserve this. And then they fell into each other's arms. And I entitled the story, and tears fell on the game ball. Joe Garagiola, who was famed for his national broadcast radio sports show, called me up and he says, I read your column. I want to use that. And a little story, and he did. And there again, a little daisy that could have been easily overlooked. Another one is a Gothenburg family whose mother and father and three of their children had all played in the University of Nebraska marching band. And in another Orange Bowl, Jack Snyder, longtime director of music, came to me and said, I have one of the hardest tasks that I've ever had in my career. But it's a beautiful task. The family brought the mother down to Miami, even though she was dying of cancer. They called me this morning and they said she passed away in her hotel. But they asked, would you please not tell Susie, their daughter, who for the first time was following the family tradition to march with the Go Big Red marching band in the Orange Bowl Spectacular. Her mom wanted her to have that choice and doesn't want her passing to ruin that. And they said, would you not tell her until after she has performed? And he said, that was the toughest, but one of the most touching moments of my life to tell her afterwards. And she was overjoyed that her mother thought enough of her, her family thought enough of her, that she too would be in little drama, insignificant to the grandeur of the football victory of Nebraska, but little stories, and that's what this is about. And I'm going to heed Christine's. Incidentally, I got to tell you one thing. I was going to write this book on my own. And I had gone out to Henderson, Nebraska, the Service Press, got some estimates. I was going to foot the bill and all that. And I, like a damn fool, I opened my mouth, and it's in the book that I wanted all proceeds of this book to go to the University of Nebraska College of Journalism to help young journalists interested in community journalism. And next thing I know, I get a call from Christine. What do you mean you are going to publish that book? We are going to publish that book. And I said, who is we? And she says, well, I'm Christine Berger. I am president of the Midlands Marketing. And I says, what in the hell is the Midlands Marketing? And she says, well, you should know it is a subsidiary of the World Herald. And we want to publish a book. And I'll tell you, she did everything. I didn't have to do a damn thing except get writer's cramp of all these damn signings I had to do all over town. And she is a gem, and I find out now she's going out on her own, she and her sister, breaking up a beautiful romance, and but she has another great assistant there, and they're going to continue whipping me, cracking a whip. But anyway, I'm going to heed her ass advice. I'm not going to tell you any more of these stories. If you want to, buy the damn book, and I'll sign up my name for it. Thank you. I'll be glad to have any questions.
Thank you, Tom. We got to share this now. Okay. We only have one microphone. It's the press.
Alan that doesn't know how to spell.
It's the press club. It's not the broadcasting club. So we only have one microphone. We have some questions. We'll go around and pick them up if anyone else has questions. What are some of the most interesting places and persons you have covered? Two of each, at least.
Two of each. Well, I always get the question phrase, what is your favorite place in Nebraska? And I always reply, wherever I am that day. The most interesting person is, I think, one of the most touching love stories was the story of Doug Stewart of Lynch, Nebraska. He was what they called the Christmas miracle down you can tell how old this was because it was down when Beatrice State Home was known as a home for the retarded. And as a 14-year-old boy in Lynch, Nebraska, his head was run over by a tractor in a farmyard accident. All the eminent medical authorities doomed him to what remained of his life as being a complete vegetable, without feeling, without sight, without speech, nothing. And I had, searching for the little stories, I had gone down to Beatrice, and Elmer Wyan, who was then the director, said, "Boy, have we got a Christmas story for you." This happened to be right before Christmas. And I also went down there because, hey, who was it? One of the radio stations, you know, who was a radio station that used to have the coffee, the strips from coffee cans, and they had a big Christmas gift deal. And I covered that for several times. But anyway, he said, "We have this Christmas that we call it the Christmas miracle." He said, "Tonight," this was Christmas Eve, he said, "tonight when his mother has driven all the way from Lynch, which is up near the South Dakota border, to sit as she does once a month, holding the lifeless hand of her son, he will suddenly squeeze her hand and very haltingly say, 'Very Merry Christmas, Mother.'" And he said, "It is a miracle because Dr. Hemperlin, who was the head of the medical services there at the home, said, it is nothing that medicine accomplished." And he named a couple of big Omaha brain specialists who said that it is a miracle because nothing that medicine did accomplish this. He said, "The love of two nurses' aides did." And he introduced me to these gals, and their folksy, matronly gals, and they said, one of them says, "I talk a lot, and every time I go in a room, there's nothing. You lay there, just a complete vegetable." And he said, "I yak up a storm to him." And after a couple of weeks, I noticed his eyes suddenly watched me, were moving. And so we kept jabbering away more. And then another couple of weeks, he started making noises like a mouse. And we said, "Darn it, Doug, if you can squeak like a mouse, you can talk like a man." And lo and behold, they taught him for this big Christmas miracle surprise for his mother. The end of that story, which applied a lot of other little issues, he not only left there, came to a rehabilitation hospital in Lincoln, he went back to Lynch, caught up with his graduation class, graduated, attended the University of Nebraska, and was a special ed teacher at, I think it was Southeast High School in Lincoln. And now he was, last time I checked with Doug, he was head of the Community Development Committee in his hometown of Lynch. Little stories. Where I like best, there's a chapter in the book, by the way, you miss it. Nebraska missed it. And it's what I consider some of the most beautiful, some of the most historical that we blow it on. Do you know that Nebraska had an active, quote, volcano, unquote, up near northeast Nebraska Newcastle, the Ionia volcano, and I hope in all this foofarah of the Lewis and Clark expedition celebration, they don't overlook it because it's in Lewis and Clark's journals about how this burning black smoke from a bluff overlooking the Missouri. And it wasn't a volcano, but geologists explained it was a shale-like elements that, when touched by water, gave off smoke and fire. And Lewis and Clark have got it there. I think Nebraska is being very jealous of their beauties. You know, two of the most gorgeous sights that few Nebraskans have seen are the Dismal River, the most misnamed river in the country, and Sow Valley Canyon. And that is in the Pine Ridge country is one of the most beautiful spots. Those gotta be. But I have so many. Read the darn book.
Well, let me ask you something that's not in the book. This is just from my my own curiosity and many others, I'm sure. How do you, as you go into a town, you're looking for stories, how do you break the ice? I mean, you're a reporter from a big town newspaper. How would you get people to talk to you? What techniques did you use? What is it about you that gets people to open up that way?
Well, I take a shower every morning. No, I always tell people, I mean, don't go to the Chamber of Commerce or City Hall if you want to find out what's really going on in the town. Go to the most popular cafe, which in a small town is usually a cafe and bar, and just sit there and talk and be friendly. And that's where you get a lot of your good stories. I mean, I'm convinced a lot of the public don't know a good story when they fall over it. And you start talking, and they say, oh, yeah, you should have been here last week. I remember I was ready to shoot the assistant editor up at Blair because he told me, oh, I wish you were here last week. What a great picture opportunity. And the marquee of the theater there adjoined, I think it was, what is it, Washington County State Bank. And it read, Washington County State Bank. And then the movie on the marquee was one of, I forgot who the star was, but it said, a nice little bank that ought to be robbed. And I said, didn't you take that picture? He says, no, I live here. I got to get along with that banker. And I said, oh, he'd have loved it. And just then the banker comes in. We're having coffee at the local. And he says, Tom, I wish you were here last week. I couldn't get anybody that got a picture of that, and we'd have loved that.
There. Well, here's a one that goes along that. How often did you go into a town and look for a story cold? Did you do that often, or did you often have a lead that you wanted to follow up on?
Well, as I say, most of the time I was leadless. I'd go in and stumble over. I was so lucky, as you'll find out in some of these stories, just bumping in, being at the right place at the right time. Like one of my craziest stories, I pride myself of having been in every town in Nebraska and having written a story about most of them. And one day, I was traveling down this gravel road, and here's a sign, worms. And I thought, well, worms. Worms is a great cathedral city in Germany. But I thought, Worms, Nebraska? And so I sat 2 miles down the road. So I pulled into town. It was empty. There was a big Lutheran church there, which kind of followed the heritage of the German worms. But anyway, I couldn't find anybody. And I was walking up and down the street. Everything was closed. And here comes a little weedy hound, a Dutch hound. Real frisky, and he took me under his paws and led me and showed me the town. And finally led me to the only person left in that community that day. A sweet little lady tending her flower garden in the back. And she said, "Oh, this is a big Lutheran town, and there's a big Lutheran conference going on down in Grand Island, and everybody left town and to attend that. And by the way, I see you met Fritz. He's our welcomer. He's our pastor's dog." And so I was ashamed of myself. I sat down and wrote this darn story about Fritz, the four-legged chamber of commerce of Worms, Nebraska. And I got more response out of that than did anything.
Read the book, though.
The book!
Well, in all your travels, now I want to start traveling around Nebraska. Where are the two or three best places, towns, to stop and have a meal?
Well, I've been gone so long, or on the road so long, that I've outlived a lot of the good places. Like Driesbach's of Grand Island, that's really not what it was in its glory days. But I tell you, my favorite spot, just because it's a great cut-the-dust spot, is Ole's Big Game Lounge and Steakhouse at Paxson. And there's a great chapter on the truth behind Ole's polar bear that sits right inside. I'm not going to tell you what. Read the book.
You'd tell us just to read the book if you didn't, if I asked you that one. Have any of the people you've written about turned the tables on you in any way?
Oh, there is a fuzzy-faced guy here today, an eminent ex-professor of journalism at the University of Nebraska, who has forgot to shave for several years now. But he was running his parents' newspaper at Neely, Nebraska. He was also city clerk of Neely, Nebraska. And so he was in with the officialdom of City Hall of Neely, Nebraska. And I go up for this big crime story. Four brothers had been ransacking farmhouses and robbing cars and all this. And it's one of the last mounted posse hunts in the history of Nebraska. And that night, being a gracious host, he invites me to the mayor's house. We're having a party. And a fire chief was there, and he brought the town's one and only emergency unit, which was a station wagon loaded with all their emergency oxygen and all this. And these four brothers chose that night to steal the town's emergency wagon from under our noses while we were partying and at the mayor's house. They found the emergency unit, I guess, about a week later out in Oregon somewhere. But the brothers, in their haste to skedaddle, left another brother who was holed up in the city park. That is, he took time to stop by a liquor store where he was spotted, and he bought a full quart of liquor. And by the time he was apprehended, he was stewed. But this great journalist, teacher of our young aspiring journalists, he thought it would be great for me. He was going to give me a scoop. I was the only reporter from anywhere there at Neely. And he said, I know the sheriff real well. Why don't I put you in the cell with the suspect? And you could have an exclusive interview. And they said, the sheriff, should I name this guy? Bud Pagel. He said, Tom, you take your time. And the sheriff and I are going to lunch. And you talk about a two martini lunch. This had to be like four or five. I was in there for 4 hours. And this guy was so stewed, all I could get out of him was, how you doing, old buddy? What are you in here for? And I was scared he was going to upchuck me on me. And I was hollering and screaming, get me out of here. And finally, about 4 o'clock, in walks this hirsute devil in the sheriff. Oh, Tom, how'd it go? We forgot about you. And he keeps telling his generations of students at the University of Nebraska how to get a scoop. Get next to the sheriff and the town clerk and have them put you in a jail cell with the main suspect. Yes.
I wish I had a professor like that.
You don't.
Did you ever expect to be at the World Herald as long as you were? And why did you stay?
And why did I stay? Somebody said, how long did you say you worked at the World Herald? I said, 54 long, arduous years. And he looked at me and he said, did you like it? And I looked at him and I said, hell no, I didn't like it. I was marking time till something better came along. And nothing ever better came along. I came to the World Herald I started my journalism career at Wellington, Kansas, Wellington Daily News. And boy, at the great sum of $10 a week. And actually, this was in the height of the Depression, the height of the Dust Bowl. And that $10, I've never had as much money since, spending money. I had Maud Dowd's boarding house, the best meals in town, the best beautiful bedroom, $4 a week. I had a free pass to the movie theater, pass to the high school football, basketball games, and I say, in those days, $10 was an immense amount. And I remember the old H.L. Wood, the old 90-year-old publisher of the Wellington Daily News. Every Saturday morning, he would come to your desk holding his business ledger with his glasses down on the end of his nose. And I don't know why he wore them. He always peeked over them. But anyway, he'd look at me and he'd say, I owe you $10. And look at me. You owe Uncle Sam, that'd be in whoever it was, and you owe the state of Kansas so much. And you damn well better have the exact change. So I probably ended up a net of, say, $8.75. But I repeat, in those days, you could get one heck of a steak dinner for 35 cents. And I had more money than the spender ever did for on my career. Okay.
Did you ever get in any trouble with your editors over the expense accounts you turned in.
Oh. Yes. They, Fred Ware. And it's too bad. Is there any Top World Herald Brass here? I get down there, and it's like a mausoleum. I mean, God, all these polished desks and all this. And, hey, I miss the old newsroom, you know, the clacking of typewriters, screaming, copy boy, get over here, and all this, and there's none of that. And I think John Gottschalk was ready to kill me because he was showing me around the new place. And he said, how you like it? I looked over and I said, John, this reminds me of the hog barn at the state fair. All these little cubicles and they rah! But I should have been fired several times. You mentioned expense accounts. And it was during the Eisenhower administration, and he started this people-to-people program. It was doctor-to-doctor, professor-to-professor, a lawyer-to-lawyer visits, international visits. And we went to Mexico, Mexico City and Acapulco. And coming back, I was thinking, Fred always demanded expense accounts be immediately presented to him so he could okay them. And I thought, well, live dangerously. So I spent a couple hours changing dollars into Mexico pesos. And I forgot what the exchange was. The inflation was pretty bad then. So that instead of like a $3 or $4 meal, it was like a $15 or $20 lunch. But I studiously made my expense account out in Mexican pesos. And I knocked on his door as soon as I got back. Can't you see I'm busy? Can't you see I'm busy? I know, Mr. Ware, you're always very busy. But I also know that you demand that expense accounts be turned in immediately. Man, this is my expense account. God, give it to me. And for some reason, they had daily sheets there, you know, breakfast, lunch, dinner, hotel, incidentals. And all he caught was just the lunch. And it was like 24 or 25 pesos, which actually in dollars, it was maybe 350 or 450. And he said, my God, $25 for lunch? If we'd have known it was going to be this expensive, we wouldn't send you. And I said, Fred, Mr. Ware, what did you want me to do? Buy a taco from a sidewalk vendor and sit on the curb and wait till the meeting was over and then interview him? Oh, my God. And he's missing like a $75 dinner and a $300 hotel room, see? And he keeps turning the page just fuming at me. Then he comes to the bottom line. And he turned white. And then he turned red. And as he came around the desk at me, he's pounding himself. Is that right? Is that right? Is that right? And it's something like 25,000. And I let him get too damn close to me before I said, yes, Mr. Ware, that's exactly right. In Mexican pesos. And he just, I thought he was going to have a heart attack. Get out of my office. I never want to see you again. And I thought, oh, boy, I went a little too far this time. Especially since about 2 minutes later, he comes storming out of his office, putting on his hat and coat. He makes a special detour past my desk, just glaring at me, and storms out the door. An hour passes, and Hugh Fogarty, who was then the managing editor, he comes over and he said, Tom, what did you do to Fred this time? And I explained that. He said, oh, God. He said, he's been a bearcat today, and you pull something like that. we had a staff meeting half an hour ago, and we can't find him. But I said, oh, I told you, Storm Dolly. Tom, it's sure been nice knowing you. It's been a pleasure. And I thought, well, and then here comes Fred in. Again, a teacher past my desk, glaring at me, goes in, slams the door of his office. And then I see his secretary is summoned in. And she comes out. It was Irene Provost, you know, the widow of our great sports columnist, Wally. But she comes out and is holding this little envelope like this and carrying it. And she was a sweetheart, and she could tell. Tom, Mr. Ware wanted me to be sure and hand this to you personally. Oh, I'm so sorry. Well, okay. I open up the envelope. There was a pink slip in there. There was also the crummiest, stinkiest, lousiest 2-peso note. That Ware must have gone out and rolled every drunk in alleys around downtown Omaha till he found somebody that had a stinking 2-peso note. On the pink slip, he had scribbled this note. Mr. Allen, you can't add any better than you can write. You shortchange yourself 2 pesos. Full payment here with FW.
So that takes care of the question, have you ever come close to being fired? What do the people from rural Nebraska, how do they perceive Omaha? What do they think of Omaha?
Well, you know, for years, I try to get the public relations people from Exarban, you know, your Exarban king and queen, and the countesses and the princesses, and I say, for Pete's sake, for public relations, Exarban is supposed to represent Nebraska. And I said, why is it that the king and the queen must come from Omaha? The countesses can come from outlying towns and the princesses, but the king and queen must come from Omaha. And the only thing I got was, well, because of the social requirements and, let's face it, the money involved, we have to have them. And I said, you dumb son of a gun, don't you realize some of those ranchers can buy and sell you out in nothing flat? And to hell with Omaha's Brandeis and Goldsteins. They use their airplanes to go shopping at Tiffany's and other places in Dallas. And don't give me that. I mean, look what a great opportunity you have. Say, okay, the king has to be from Omaha. How about letting some poor little rancher's daughter on the South 40 be your queen? Look at the fairy tale or the Cinderella angle. Oh, no, it's got to be this way. And you ask what other people outside, they'd laugh like heck at prominent Omahans in silk Louis the 16th panties parading down the coronation ball. And there always has been this feeling outstate. And don't call it outstate, outstate. Call it greater Nebraska, outstate. You're telling them, oh, you're out of us. You're really not part of it. But there's always been that feeling that Omaha and Lincoln don't care about us out here. In fact, one of the crises is always solved. You know, every few years you have the panhandle is going to succeed to Wyoming. And it always ends with, you say, well, fine, but will you please sell us your season football ticket. So that usually ends that crisis for a while.
The pounding noise you hear is because they're remodeling the floor below us, and they have chosen under this very room and, in fact, under this very podium to pound at this very moment. So appreciate the sound effects. What do you think of the Nebraska marching band not going to this year's bowl game?
Well, I cover Nebraska football, and I strongly object to the Gray World Herald, all the radio and television stations. They completely, in their game coverage, completely ignore the band. I mean, these kids, there's 300 of them. And boy, as their little daisy stories about them, the football team, we make big banner headlines about the poor football players sweating out two-a-days in pre-season training. These band kids, on their own, no scholarships, they have to pay their own way, come down and have four-a-days at times when the football team isn't using the field. And you talk about the cut. On the last Sunday, they post a list, and 50 to 60 of them are summarily cut. If your name ain't on there, kids, too bad. You ain't marching for the marching Go Big Red. And I used to stay with a band at bowl games because it was more fun. I mean, the top brass at the university always stayed at the Regents and all this, the Whoopee Cruises at the old Fontainebleau and all this. And the band was usually shuffled like Hollywood. And it was the greatest PR for the University of Nebraska because Hollywood adopted that band. The band put on concerts in the park for them and all this. I always remember one of the greatest football games I ever saw. Sure, it was flag football, but it was the year that Notre Dame and Nebraska were playing in the Orange Bowl. The band and the Notre Dame's band had this big flag football game. Anyway, the trophy was a battered old trumpet, and it's still hanging over in the band's deal. But I like that little daisy I told you about the marching band, the Gothenburg family, mother dead, making sure that their kid got a chance to. And it's also, that pride is also shown in the annual Alumni Day deal. How many of these old bandsmen come back to once more march for Go Big Red? I kill him. The band is the only one that really gives a hoot about Nebraska.
Tom, in all the writing you did, did you ever feel you were exploiting people when you wrote about their problems or their illnesses or the deaths?
Well, I tried not to, and I imagine just being telling a story, you're exploiting them. But one of the stories here is I talked a demented Dennis out of a armed siege. His house was ringed by sheriff and highway patrolmen. And because he had written the World Herald Public Pulse, the old Public Pulse editor, he called him from this siege and told him that the highway patrol and the sheriff were had him holed up in the gun bay, gun point in his house. And Zimmerman said, well, we have a reporter who'll be glad to come out and talk to you. He said, Zim said he'd be glad to come out. Not me, but anyway, Zim then called me, and I happened to be at National Guard drill. But Zim didn't tell me that this demented Dennis was against war and the military. He had founded. He lived a little too early. I mean, if he'd been a national hero a few years later, but he was a founder of the No More War Party. And what had happened, a young airman in uniform went to his office to pick up his wife, who was a patient of the dentist, and the dentist pulled a gun on him, threatened to shoot him, just a warmonger. And so his family and the county attorney, this was up at St. Paul, Howard County, they wanted him committed to the psychiatric unit down in Hastings. And I got there, and I knew the sheriff, the veteran old Schenck, and Captain Harold Smith, the head of the criminal division, and I said, I'm told that he wants to talk to a reporter, and I'm here. And luckily, I had left the National Guard drill and had taken off my tunic, my blouse, and put on a sport coat. And I didn't realize I had the Army shirt with a big Red Bull patch on my right left sleeve. And, I was real smart. They said, well, if you want to go in and try and talk to him, take that ring off your finger. And, boy, it was a Red Bull Division ring. And I thought, boy, I'm pure now. And they said, and don't mention anything about the American Legion. He goes berserk. He had gone in and fired a shotgun a couple of times into the roof of the American Legion meeting and called them all a bunch of communists. And you don't do that in a small town, which has a famous Legion steakhouse. And I get in there to talk to him, and I almost died. Because when he finally let me in, he's in his shorts, and he's holding a big butcher knife that he's honed on his dental lathe and a gun in the other hand, and he says, come on in. I want to show you something. And he shows me this arsenal on the bed. In the middle of these rifles and hatchets and all this is a human skull. And he's pacing across the bald head, the American Legion, after his actions. And I think, oh, God, how did I ever get in this? And I became the public relations man for the No More War Party. And I said, Doc, what we need is pictures to show. I mean, how the damn American Legion got you holed up in your own house. And so he said, good idea. And I says, well, you're going to have to let me out to go to my car to get my camera. Okay, don't try anything fancy. And so I got out and I got hold of the sheriff. And I said, hey, we're gaining ground. I am now the public relations man. And I am going back in, and we're going to map out the public relations plan for the No More War Party, and I'm going to take the picture, and I'm going to talk him into letting one of you guys in. And I go back, and he shows me the secret file. We had to pull up bricks from a basement wall, showed him the pictures of the secret files of the No More War Party, president, this doctor, vice president, him, secretary, treasurer, him, so on. And he says, oh, and then this beautiful. And here's a letter from Senator Carl Curtis, kind of a form letter. And he said, isn't this beautiful? And I said, dear doctor, I am a full accord. I am against war. Thank you very much. Anything else I could do for you, Carl? Of course. Isn't that beautiful? And I said, oh, that's wonderful. And finally I said, he said, we're going to have dinner. You ever have banana melon? I had never had it. But it looked like a big cantaloupe type of deal. And he says, well, we're going to eat this. And I said, hey, I got a buddy out, and he's dying of thirst and food. Can I come in, talk him into coming in? And he said, who is he? Is he a member of the American Legion? I said, oh, no, he's not a member of the American Legion. And I said, he's a nice guy, and he'll be very understanding of your plight. And, okay, but don't try anything. I go out, I get Captain Smith, and I said, Smitty, whatever you do, don't mention the American Legion. And isn't there something I want you to see as we walk past the bedroom, turn left, and I said, but don't try anything fancy. We get to the door, and I forget Smitty's in his uniform. And, whoa! I said, highway patrol, station patrol, you know, save lives on the highway. Oh, okay. And he let us in, and I thought old Smitty was going to faint when he saw those guns. By then, we were like two poker players scared of Trump and IRAs. But he was smarter. He kept between us and the arsenal. And he served us this banana melon, as he called it. And he said, you need some pepper on there. And he had a can of pepper. And when he started to dust my melon, the top came off and mine was covered. And he thought that was funnier than hell. He said, eat it. And I ate it. And I was belching, flame. And then our great head of criminal investigation of the state of Nebraska made one tactical error. After we got through eating, old Doc says, I tell you what, you're going to be my guest and we're going to sleep here tonight. And Smitty said, oh, no, I have a dental appointment in Lincoln tomorrow morning. Oh, sit in this chair. I'll take care of it. And I kidded old Captain Smith until the day of his death. You loused up a great picture of me. You could have been in that chair and I could have had a picture of him leaning over the grill of that tooth. But anyway, then we got, I forgot how we, oh, I said, how about us really fooling and making a fool out of the American Legion? I said, we'll pretend like we're going to go to bed. Smitty will go out and tell one of his lieutenants, Lieutenant Byler, to back the cruiser up to the back door. And we'll get in the cruiser and take out the back way and leave the great American Legion all in the bag. He thought, that was wonderful. And he said, but first we got to go down and dig up the files. We got to take the files with us. Then he says, oh, by the way, I want to play us a song before we go. And he had a concertino that was minus some of the keys and all this. And he said, what do you want me to play? And I looked at him and I said, show me the way to go home. And it was nothing like that tune, but he showed the tune. Then Byler is in uniform, and he balks about getting, I said, safety patrol, remember, safe. And I've never forgiven them because they put me in the back seat with them, which made good sense because one of them had a gun on him hidden in this. And Doc, I said, Doc, get down on the floor. We don't want the Legion to know that we're tricking them. And I remember they were pushing faces this way as we backed out of the driveway. And halfway down the Grand Island to the courthouse, he said, "Man, I've never known so much traffic on this road." Well, it was, we were ringed with highway patrol cars. And then he suggests we go to a bootlegger friend of his and have a good drink. And I said, "Doc, this is a highway patrol. They frown on that. All this bootlegger, he'd love to see him. He'd love to entertain him." By then, we pulled into the driveway, and 50 hands come out and grabbed him. Well, I felt bad because I had basically lied to him. I had conned him into giving up. And I went back to his cell, and I said, "Doc, I want to apologize. I mean, I am against war, and anybody that's a veteran is more against war than the greatest of peacenik, because they know from actual experience what it means. But, and I lied to you. I conned you. But I did it because I knew that something would happen. A car would backfire, and you start firing, and they start firing, and you and somebody else, innocent. Oh, that's all right. I like you. You're the best PR guy I ever had." Incidentally, he served some time at the Hastings psychiatric unit, who was the best dentist he ever had. And then went back, and I hate to say it, but he ran on the Republican ticket twice for Congress from Spalding, Nebraska, but both times he, for some reason, he didn't make it.
Well, now I'm going to have to read the book. The stories are too good. I'm going to have to read the book. I'd like to thank our guest, Tom Allen, today. Thank you all for being here. Thanks to KIOS for broadcasting our program. And we are adjourned.
You've been listening to a luncheon broadcast from the Omaha Press Club. Today's guest was retired Omaha World Herald columnist Tom Allen, author of To Bucktail and Back, A Million Miles of Memories. This program was recorded by KIOS-FM on Thursday, February 20th, 2003, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Chris Allen for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. The Omaha Press Club holds these noontime educational forums each month. The next forum will be on Thursday, March 20th at 12 noon. The guest speaker will be U.S. Navy Captain James C. Taylor, Chief of Public Affairs at U.S. Stratcom. If you'd like to attend this or other future forums, call the Omaha Press Club at 345-8008. These events are open to both members and non-members of the Omaha Press Club. The Omaha Press Club is located on the 22nd floor of the First National Center, 16th and Dodge, in downtown Omaha. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.